If you think back to the end of the Cold War, most of us think we know what happened. America beat the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union collapsed. But in fact, the two events were very different. The West clearly won the Cold War when the Berlin Wall fell in 1989, but the USSR lingered on for two more years. Its ultimate collapse had little to do with Washington, though that unleashed a myth of American power that led right to disasters in Afghanistan and Iraq. What really happened as the USSR tore itself apart is the subject of Last Empire, a remarkable blow-by-blow account based on recently released documents and written by Professor Serhiy Plokhii, director of the Ukrainian Research Institute at Harvard University, and it's published by Basic Books. Welcome to this episode of the Lionel Gelber Podcast. We're hosting discussions with five authors whose works are shortlisted for the 2015 Lionel Gelber Prize for Best Book in International Relations. The prize is sponsored by the Lionel Gelber Foundation and the Monk School of Global Affairs in the University of Toronto in partnership with Foreign Policy Magazine. I'm Rob Steiner. Serhiy Plokhii joins us from Boston. Serhiy, welcome.
Hi, Rob. It's a pleasure to be on your program.
So we're in this book, and you take us into these chaotic events between August and December 1991 that I think a lot of people who aren't Russia watchers sort of forget. And frankly, it seems like a gong show. You have Yeltsin forcing Gorbachev to fire his whole cabinet on live TV without having made any plan for this. You have a Ukrainian foreign minister basically jumping off a train on his way to a meeting with the Romanian foreign minister because he wants to avoid him. You have different groups of plotters sort of racing in their planes to Crimea and to Kiev, sort of like Cannonball Run, hoping to get there first and land first. You were there, presumably, for part of this. Do you remember what it was possible to even know at the time? I mean, do you remember what it was like to watch this go on and where you were?
Well, actually, for most of the time that I describe in the book, and this is time from August of 91 until December, I was in Canada. I came to Montreal on the first flight, Aeroflot flight, that left Moscow during the coup. It was on August 20th, 1991, and I remember I was welcomed by the biggest group of TV crews and cameramen and correspondents, because a friend who was picking me up at the airport told them that his friend, spoke English, and so I was interviewed and ended up on most of Canadian TV programs. So I saw what was happening in Moscow during the first day and a half of the coup, and it was impossible to actually guess what was going on. Everyone was asking questions, where is Gorbachev, what happened to him, whether he was still alive or not. So from that point of view, for me, it was really very interesting to go back to work with the archival materials, with memoirs, to find out what was happening during those days in Moscow and then in the entire Soviet Union in the fall of 91.
Well, in fact, that experience sort of underscores just how impossible it would have been from outside, certainly, to have any sense of what's going on. We're talking about a major power, nuclear football that's being passed back and forth between one general and another. And we expect people like the President of the United States to know, but if all these reporters are lining up at Montreal's airport to interview a junior faculty member who's just arrived only because he speaks English, it really reminds us of a time when we couldn't have any idea of what was going on inside of Russia, and Russians and Ukrainians presumably didn't either.
Well, you're absolutely right, but the most interesting part for me was that I then discovered that President Bush and Prime Minister Mulroney and other world leaders, they were actually watching CNN and they were listening to the radio and they were getting their news from there and not from there, from CIA or Secret Service. So Bush and his national security advisor learned about the coup from the CNN report, not from the State Department, not from the CIA. And the same is true for the James Baker, who was at that time on vacation, the Secretary of State in the United States.
So let's talk about this coup, because the coup, I mean, most of us remember an image of Yeltsin on a tank with a Russian flag, but we sort of forget what the significance of this was. And you point out that the coup itself was sort of the driving event, because Yeltsin, when a group of hardline communists staged a coup against Gorbachev, was on holiday in Crimea, Yeltsin fought the hardline communists and defeated the coup, but not in the name of the Soviet Union, in the name of Russia. I mean, if it hadn't been for that, would there still be a Soviet Union today?
Well, absolutely. The victory, Yeltsin's victory, was victory for Russia and for Russian Federation. And I remember a column marching in the center of Moscow shouting Yeltsin and Russia, and then calling people to join them. And one of the older women, babushka, on the street said, "Do you want me to join for Gorbachev?" And the answer was, "Well, for Gorbachev too, but really, really, it was Yeltsin and Russia that were the winners." The question is, what would happen if the coup would actually succeed? Well, I think that the chances that the Soviet Union, the old Soviet Union, would survive with the coup succeeding are still very, very small, because the coup started at the time when Yeltsin and Gorbachev already made a deal, according to which Yeltsin, that means Russia, the Russian Federation, took control over all revenues coming from oil and gas. That meant that the old Soviet Union was gone, and what could replace it, possibly some kind of a confederation in which Russia and Yeltsin would play leading role.
But would Gorbachev, if the coup hadn't happened, I mean, quite apart from whether it had won, but if the coup hadn't actually happened, would Gorbachev have stayed in control of this sort of change of the Soviet Union into a sort of a Russia-led confederation? Would Yeltsin have sort of just gone on the sidelines as a sort of drunken boor that we sort of knew him to be ultimately? Or was he an inevitable leader of the next step here?
No, there was also a personal rivalry between these two figures, and it would be wrong to attribute the fall of the Soviet Union, the rise of Russia, to the kind of relations that Yeltsin and Gorbachev had. But certainly the personal rivalry between them played an important role in the disintegration of the Soviet Union. And those two were jockeying for power, and it was impossible for Gorbachev to imagine that he would play a secondary role to Yeltsin. And in the Russia-led confederation, I can't see how there could be other outcome.
The whole story also underscores a kind of a tension. There's a real tension there. In addition to the tension between Yeltsin and Gorbachev, there's a massive tension between the Ukraine and Russia as a whole. You know, it's interesting speaking, you know, now as fighting continues to intensify in eastern Ukraine, between Russia and the Ukraine. Most of us on the outside who haven't been watching this had no sense of the centrality of that tension between Russia and the Ukraine. I mean, in a sense, that was one of the driving forces in the end of the Soviet Union, wasn't it?
Absolutely, it was. And this is one of the reasons why the Soviet Union really was done and finished after the Ukrainian referendum on December 1st, 1991. So the vote that was put for referendum was not the future of the USSR per se, it was the independence of Ukraine. But once more than 90% of people in Ukraine, including in the Crimea, including in eastern Ukraine and today's Donbass, voted for independence, there was a consensus in Moscow between Yeltsin and Gorbachev, a consensus between Gorbachev and Bush that the Soviet Union had no future. And Yeltsin, on more than one occasion, explained to Bush why he believed that the Soviet Union without Ukraine made no sense for Russia. He said that Ukraine was the second largest republic. It was the Slavic republic. And without Ukraine, Russia, Yeltsin's Russia in particular, they were not interested in joining the union with Central Asian republics and becoming, as they believed, a major economic donor to that region.
Well, it almost sounds like a kind of a reverse of the dynamic that you have now, in the sense that, you know, the way that the conflict today between, you know, within the Ukraine is pictured by a lot of people is it's a fight within the Ukraine of whether it should be east or west. But it almost sounds like in 1991, the fight was in Russia, whether it should turn west and be part of a Slavic bloc with the Ukraine, or turn east and be part of an Asian bloc with the Islamic republics in its mm-hmm. south and east, and that it chose when it couldn't be sort of a Slavic nation, it would rather just go on its own rather than become the grandmother of the Eastern countries.
Right, right. And the position that Russia should go on its own was represented by Yeltsin and people around him. And the idea of saving the Soviet Union at any cost, even if that would be Central Asian republics maybe and plus Russia, was represented by Gorbachev. What, however, one should keep in mind, and I was surprised to find that in the documents that I read, was that even in the fall of 91, Russia was not prepared to give up on its leading role in the post-Soviet space. So the decision was made that Russia didn't have enough resources to support other republics. It would go alone with its economic reform program. But in the course of the next 20 years, advisors were telling Yeltsin, other republics will come back. So the idea was that Russia would not be burdened with there would be no financial burden for maintaining the empire. But Russia would still maintain its control in those areas. And Ukraine was crucial for the continuation of the Soviet Union in 91. And today Ukraine is crucial for this program of the restoration of the Russian influence over the Soviet space. So that's why it's the only republic of the former Soviet Union where we see actually that Russia annexes territory, sends it troops, and actually worsens relations with the West to a degree that many people talk now about the Cold War.
So
Ukraine is so important in the opinion of people in Kremlin.
Well, so explain that importance, because it's a consistent theme right from the events you're describing in 1991 with Yeltsin and Gorbachev and Kravchuk in Kiev, right from those events. All the way, and in fact, Bush, not only when Bush goes to visit Gorbachev, he doesn't just go to visit Gorbachev, he goes just in advance of this time in August of 91, he goes actually to the Ukraine too. So Ukraine's at the center of that. Explain, and of course, it's in the center of today's dynamic with Putin. So I'm not quite sure I understand the importance of the Ukraine to Russia. Is it an economic importance because the Ukraine will subsidize Russia's ability to subsidize the rest of the Soviet space? Or is it an ethnic importance that Russians just don't feel Russian if they're not with the Ukraine?
Well, I think it's all of the above. So on the one hand, really in terms of the pure number of people, it's in terms of the numbers, this is the second Soviet Republic. In terms of its economic output, again, it's second only to Russia. So economically, the Eurasian Union that Putin was trying to put in place, trying to create, would actually be much stronger and much stronger force than any union between Russia and Central Asian republics without Ukraine. And you're also absolutely right that what we see is the unfinished process, really, of the formation of modern Russian identity. Russians still believe that the origins of Russia are in Kiev. Many of them believe that Ukrainians are just a variety of Russians. They're part of the bigger Russian nation. The most important fact is that Mr. Putin believes in that and went on record saying that Russians and Ukrainians are basically the same people. So this is unfinished process of the formation of modern Russian national identity is also a major factor in what is going on today in Ukraine, because the intervention in eastern Ukraine is taking place under the banners of the so-called Russian world, which is the concept of this Russian identity based on orthodoxy and very different to the corrupt West. So the Russians look at the Ukrainians as corrupt Russians, the ones who are just fooled by the West and don't know what they're doing and should be saved from themselves.
It seems that one of the themes that you're pointing to, both in the current dynamic and in the dynamic that you're describing in the breakup of the Soviet Union, is Russia's sort of uncertainty of its role in the world. I mean, is it on the one hand an ethnic state whose job it is to protect the interests of ethnic Russians wherever they are, or is it a global power that has to actually be a little bit more subtle in its relationship with its neighbors like the Ukraine in order to actually continue to have global influence?
Well, the problem of whether Russia is a nation state or it is an empire, this is a problem that apparently accompanies good part of Russian modern history. And a lot of writers, historians, and observers will point into that, to that problem and to that issue. What we see now, today, is that these two things, the imperial agenda and the agenda that is associated with the Russian nation state, they work together in the mind of people in Kremlin supporting each other. So there is a vision that Russia should come back as a major world power. To do that, it has to reestablish its control over the post-Soviet space and potentially parts of the former Eastern Europe. And the way to get there is through mobilizing ethnic Russian minorities and Russian speakers, the people who speak Russian, read Russian, and in one way or another take part in the Russian culture. So the mobilization of this group outside of Russian borders goes hand in hand with this broader imperial program. So again, if people from the West look at that as a major issue and problem, and I agree with that, people maybe in Russia look at that as complementary things that don't contradict each other and that help to achieve the programs associated both with the nation-state agenda and imperial agenda.
So if we cast our minds back sort of 23 years roughly to the time when you know, the time that you're describing this book, you point out that there were some things that really surprised you. In fact, a lot of the book, it's fat with endnotes and bibliography. A lot of it comes from recently released documents. You couldn't have known this stuff at the time that it was going on. What surprised you as you looked back at it?
Well, the first surprise comes with the understanding of how little people in the West and in the United States in particular, at the highest levels of government, knew about what was really going on in Moscow and in that part of the world. We were talking about the coup and the fact that Bush learns about the coup from TV, and the same was true for James Baker. And this pattern of really lack of information, it continues into the fall of 91 and then into December of 91. So that was first surprise. Again, we tend to believe that the intelligence agencies, the analysts that work for the State Department, for the government in general, know what is actually going on the ground. It looks like they know more than average reader or listener knows, but not too much. And the second surprise came with this discovering the fact that very early on, Russia was not prepared to give up on its role in the post-Soviet space. And that the thinking of Yeltsin and people around him in terms of forming the future union or confederation was so deeply rooted in this understanding of who are Slavs and who are not Slavs, orthodoxy and the Islam and Muslim world. And that was coming basically from people who grew up, who were educated in the communist system that was or tried to be blind to such things as religion and nationality, but they were thinking in those terms, certainly in 1990 and 91.
There's such a persistence of identity here, and obviously we know the story out of Yugoslavia and how identities that have presumably been buried for a long time come back to the fore. But there's a moment in your book when you describe Yeltsin climbing up on the tank, protecting the Russian parliament from, you know, the Soviet forces as they still were, and actually pulling out a Russian flag. And I even sort of wonder where would he have gotten that, which leads to a larger question. That old woman in the street who's asking, do you want me to cheer for Russia or for the Soviet mm-hmm. Union? Mm-hmm. How was Russia even still an option in people's minds at the time? Is it just can't erase this stuff?
Mm-hmm. Well, Yeltsin himself was a relatively late kind of participant of this Russia First rally, but it was certainly gaining speed during perestroika years. By 1990, against the protests from Gorbachev, the Russian Communist Party was created. So before that, there was just the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, and then other republics had Communist Party, but not Russia. So there was this movement that was associated both with the liberals and with the conservatives that was pushing for the rights of Russia in the Soviet Union. And Yeltsin and people around him, they capitalized on that trend and that tendency that was there already by the time of the coup. So what happened during the coup and a little bit earlier was that the liberal strand, strand in Russian politics, and this conservative, they came together and created a short-lived alliance that also contributed to the fall of the Soviet Union.
So the other thing you say surprised you was how little we in the West knew about what was going on at the time. We presumably had spies and satellites and so on, but we still didn't know what was actually going on day to day. And here we are today. We read about the NSA having massive sweeps of data. We have drones and satellites in the sky. We presumably have a larger Russian diaspora living in the West and more Westerners living in Russia. Do we actually know any more today about how Russian leaders are thinking, what they're planning, than we did then? Are we as blind, or are we actually better at this now?
Well, I would be much more comfortable asking this question, let's say, 20 years from now, when we hopefully get access to the Russian archives or Ukrainian archives and Canadian and American ones. But my guess is that hopefully we know more. The big question is, of course, what do we do with that information? First of all, from the idea that one gets reading this mass harvesting of information, electronic information, how you make your way through that, how you decide on what is important and what is not important. So in a sense, with more information coming in, the task of understanding the situation and making the right decisions may be becoming even more difficult, not easier.
Has the book been released in Russia and in the Ukraine and in Eastern Europe?
No. Right now, I know that it will appear in Chinese. It will appear in Polish, in Poland. There was a very positive review published in Moscow Times and Kyiv Post. But generally, until the book is translated in such markets as Russia and Ukraine, you don't see much reviews or feedback. But in terms of my colleagues in both countries, I am very grateful to them. The response was very positive.
Last question that I would have is, what do you think if Barack Obama or John Kerry is reading this book, what should they take away from it in their application of foreign policy to the Soviet Union, now I'm getting, I have so much in 1991, I'm getting confused. Their application of foreign policy to Russia and Eastern Europe right now, what's the big lesson you'd want them to be taking away?
Well, as time passes by, more and more people look back at the policies of George Bush Sr. and find them to be really very balanced and effective. And one thing that also surprised me, I saw how much time he was spending on the phone, talking to the leaders all around the world. Prime Minister Mulroney was one of people with whom he spoke probably the most. So exchanging information and building these alliances and building a common position vis-a-vis the Soviet Union. And what was happening in 1990-91 was Bush, when Bush was speaking, the understanding in Moscow and in Kyiv, in Almaty, in any other Union Republic was that actually he represented a united front. And again, there were very particular circumstances of the time. The Cold War was either over or really living its last days. The situation is different today, but again, if the that kind of unanimity of the Western countries can be somehow recreated, that would make this enormous and very difficult time of solving Russian-Ukrainian crisis and war much easier.
Sergei Plokhy is the author of The Last Empire. Thank you very much for joining
us.
If you would like to hear more from the Lionel Gelber podcast series, we have discussions with five leading authors on international affairs this year, along with more than 25 others from the last 3 years. You can find them all on iTunes by searching for Lionel Gelber, that's G-E-L-B-E-R, or online at monkschool.utoronto.ca, that's monk is N-U-N-K, school.utoronto.ca/Gelber. I'm Rob Steiner, director of the Monk School's Fellowships in Global Journalism. Thank you for joining us.